Somebody had a hashtag super sexy Jew hunk or something. I mean, who knows? I never thought of him as a heartthrob. However, you know, I've heard from some women who are in like a secret Facebook group where they all just, you know, love him and, you know, share pictures and talk about, you know, their favorite Harolds and all this stuff. So, you know, it's interesting to have that sort of unfolding that happens after someone is gone, you know, where other people now sort of keep them alive for you and show you new things about them that you never knew before.
When your father is known for being one of the founders of modern comedy, you don't really consider them as attractive or iconic. For Violet Ray Mastille, she just loved her dad.
I was lucky enough to have a dad who, you know, could talk about Buddhism or, you know, Jewish social philosophy, but also liked to listen to my, you know, terrible music when I was a teenager. I mean, I think in his work too, he could operate at a very high intellectual level, but he also really liked to get silly and, you know, and goof around. So it was great to have someone who was so dynamic and could really contain all of these multitudes.
Welcome to A Life Lived. I'm Stephanie O'Kupniak. Harold Alan Ramis was born in Chicago on November 21st, 1944. His parents ran a grocery store, and they lived in a cramped two-bedroom apartment with his grandparents, his aunt, his uncle, and his brother. From the age of 8, Harold started bagging groceries with his brother at their store. He loved his family, so much so that it's rumored he used his bar mitzvah money to buy his mother wall-to-wall carpeting.
He read, when he was 12, you know, The Unexamined Life is Not Worth Living, and he really took it to heart. And so part of it is that he wanted to excel and be the best. So he joined a lot of clubs in high school. He studied German because it was the language of doctors, and he thought he was going to be a neurosurgeon. But, you know, he definitely was often the smartest guy in the room. And I would tell him, you know, you're too smart. And he said, no, I just have been around forever, so I know a lot of things.
He started a folk band called The Wanderers at the age of 14. He was brilliant, entertaining, confident, and had no idea what was in store for him. In 1962, Harold went to Washington University in St. Louis. Looking back, he described his time there as, "I started college looking like John F. Kennedy and finished college looking like John Lennon, with the politics of Nikolai Lenin." He joined a fraternity, experimented with drugs, dove into acting and writing, and shortly after graduation, he got married. He tried grad school for a few weeks, but quickly realized it wasn't for him. He went on to work in several odd jobs. He was a taxi driver, a full-time substitute teacher, and an adult psychiatric worker on a locked ward. In an interview with ONTV in 1982, he described his short stint in the hospital, saying, "I wanted to compare my own psychedelic hallucinogenic experience to madness to see what the lines were. It was a great job for learning a lot quickly about people and your own madness. You think twice before you say, 'I'm going crazy.'"
He was a draft dodger. Well, he was a pacifist, and, you know, lazy and not into following rules. So there was no way he was joining the military, not to mention the fact that he, you know, did not believe in what the war was supposedly fighting for. You know, he was definitely a peace lover at the time. And so, yeah, he got his draft notice. He went down to the office. He said he was... I think he had taken a bunch of speed, you know, the night before, stayed up all night, so he looked extra cracked out and disgusting, and, said he was gay, said he was a drug addict, anything you could, flat feet. I'm sure he threw it all in there, and, yeah, they let him go. There was no way he was going into the military, and, you know, I think Stripes was sort of you know, a great nod to that, because it was like, all right, we're going to do this military thing, but we're going to do it in our own way. And he would have been no help to anyone. And, you know, what a terrible war. Anyway.
In his downtime, he studied with the improv theater company Second City. It was here that he would find comrades in comedy. He eventually became a member of their touring company. In 1968, he was hired as the party jokes editor for Playboy magazine. He was surprised at how basic and vanilla most of the jokes were that he received. He once talked about being in Hugh Hefner's grotto, surrounded by the naked cast of Hair, in the pool singing, "Let the Sun Shine In," and thinking, "It doesn't get better than this." In 1974, fellow Second City actor John Belushi invited Harold to New York City to write and perform for the new show, The National Lampoon Radio Hour.
All of those people were around throughout my early childhood, you know, the Murray brothers, Bill and Brian, and John Belushi, and Gilda Radner, and Joe Flaherty, and more. I mean, it was just such an amazing group of really, again, smart, funny people who, you know, loved playing together, and luckily their play was work. So I think, you know, in sort of transitioning from Second City to The Lampoon to SCTV, I mean, it was almost, you know, I mean, who knows? There are no coincidences, but what a great way to sort of not only break into an industry, but really, you know, break the mold, kind of surrounded by, you know, all of these other people who share your, you know, a vision with you for a new kind of comedy and work.
His success was surrounded by playful chaos, and his home was growing. In 1977, Harold and his wife Anne had Violet. Harold was a natural father and enjoyed caring for Violet and frequently taking naps with her.
My dad was my primary parent from when I was a baby, so we were together all the time. So all of my earliest memories are of him, of, you know, grabbing onto his leg so as not to get lost at a party, or, you know, having him feed me or, you know, give me a bath. And it was really just sort of the very simple things like that, you know, having someone make you hot dogs and tater tots when you're three. I mean, that's a big deal at the time. So it's really just those small things that I remember now the most.
While working with Second City TV and National Lampoon, he was recruited to co-write the comedy classic Animal House. The film shares the adventures of two college freshmen attempting to pledge to a fraternity house that is under threat by the school's dean. It was a tremendous success. Caddyshack was Harold's directorial debut.
Four!
He reunited with Doug Kenny to develop the institutional comedy about youth revolting against the establishment.
With Caddyshack, the first movie that he directed, you know, he really did not know anything. He joked that it was a $7 million film school education in making that movie. And the truth is, he really used what he'd learned in improvisation through Second City in the film. I mean, Dad would just say, okay, like, who has an idea for this scene? And anybody could come to him with ideas, and they were really willing to try anything because he didn't have that formal training saying, yes, you can do this, you cannot do that. So there were no rules to play by. They were all definitely, I think, in an altered state much of the time. And, you know, who knows how that affected the film in terms of what they thought was funny. clearly, a lot of people agreed with them. But I think my dad, looking back, always, you know, wished that it had been a little tighter, a little less sort of loosey-goosey than it was. But, you know, it's a classic, so can't complain too much.
Harold's friendship with Bill was tried and tested on the set of Caddyshack. Bill was a formidable force on his own, and as an inexperienced director, Harold allowed him to move at his own pace. A working friendship that would blossom.
My dad knew his brother Brian first. They worked together at Second City, and then he met Bill, and you know, I think you recognize right away, oh, that guy's a star, you know, even a reluctant star sometimes. And I think they just were such a great complement to each other. You know, everybody needs a straight man. And they, you know, they really gave each other what they each needed for a very long time professionally. And I think Bill, you know, was able to, you know, be as great as he was because he could count on my dad to write great material for him. And he knew that he wasn't going to make him, you know, look bad or say something stupid. And I think my dad really liked having this sort of alter ego in a way to write for someone who was wild and would say, you know, all the things that nobody else had the guts to say. And so, you know, they created so much incredible comedy together.
It was this relationship that convinced Ivan Reitman to hire the pair for the 1981 comedy Stripes. He wanted Bill for the film and thought he would be more inclined to sign if Harold worked on it with him. The chemistry between Ivan, Bill, and Harold was kinetic. Stripes was Harold's third great film success, and in many ways, it paved the way for Ghostbusters. Before trapping ghosts, he'd have to take the nuclear American family on a road trip they'll never forget, with National Lampoon's Vacation. Harold directs Chevy Chase as he desperately tries to salvage a road trip with his family to Wally World. Harold's talent for directing was becoming more polished, and a string of successes made him one of the most desirable comedic directors in Hollywood. Ghostbusters was originally conceived because Dan Aykroyd is fascinated by the paranormal. The script was a combination of Dan, Ivan, and Harold's comedy styles and input.
I was in New York while they were filming here, and it was, you know, so exciting. And, you know, a very different time, obviously. So, you know, 1983 New York is not what we know today. So it felt like, you know, a little dangerous and edgy and, you know, like Madonna could walk around the corner at any moment. But there was just so much sort of joy in what they were doing. And you know, I think they really fed off the energy of the city. I think Ghostbusters, as the thing that he was sort of most widely known for, was also something that he really just had so much affection for. I think, you know, he talked about when they were making Ghostbusters and, you know, that they sort of knew that it was going to be a big hit. And I'm sure that they did, because they were doing something, you know, pretty original for the time. And it just had that, you know, that magic. But I don't think he could have ever anticipated, you know, sort of how it would take on a life of its own, and how, you know, there are huge communities that have sprung up around Ghostbusters.
Ernie Hudson played Winston Vedemore, bringing the Ghostbusters to a foursome. And though we can't think of anyone else in the film emphasizing the importance of a Twinkie better, he was not originally their first choice.
I met Harold on Space Hunter. And then when Ghostbusters came out, I think they thought I was wrong for the film, and I couldn't get an audition. I mean, I could not get, my agent couldn't get me on. It was seeing everybody, but I think the character I played in Space Hunter was so different than Winston. The character in Space Hunter was kind of big and boisterous and, you know, kind of a, you know, egomaniac, strong guy. And that was certainly not the character in Ghostbusters. So I think Ivan felt that, and so they really didn't see me. It was months after they had been casting that they finally gave me an audition, and I knew that I had to go in and connect in the audition, and Harold was there, and I think his presence in the audition was kind of reaffirming. I just felt very, very connected. So Harold always had was always kind of a little chuckle in his laugh, you know, a little smile. He always kind of which is in some ways, you know, is disarming. You know, he was quite an unusual guy in the sense that he was hugely successful, very, very talented, and still remained very down to earth and very warm and just a regular guy. And I don't see that happen a lot in people. But he just he knew who he was. And when I came into the whole Ghostbuster franchise, it was a lot of, it felt like insanity. You know, I was kind of starting out. I'd been working for a while as an actor, but I was just getting into the film business in a, you know, I mean, this is a big movie. But Harold was always the go-to guy who would just take the time, no matter what was happening, and sort of explain. You know, he knew these guys. They had worked together for so many years. I felt he was a good friend. But he was the voice of reason in the whole Ghostbuster experience. And when you're dealing with people, you know, like Bill Murray and Danny Aykroyd and even Ivan Reitman, who produced and directed, you know, they're all very talented, and, you know, there's a lot of things going on. And you always got the most important thing for Harold was that everybody was okay. He would always, no matter how busy he was, he would always take the time to just, not just listen, but to just sit down and connect in a real way. You know, there was a certain integrity and I think he was the glue that kind of held Ghostbusters and all the people together, for sure. I think Harold was one of those guys he wanted to make sure that Bill Murray looked good. You know, he wanted to make sure that the movie worked, or that, you know, Danny, you know, that, because a lot of people, you know, it's about them, and they, you know, or they, you know, I really felt that he didn't mind, you know, taking that second position and making sure that everybody else, you know, looked great. And nobody doubts that Ghostbusters would not be Ghostbusters had it not been for Harold Ramis's contribution. I mean, his presence in the writing and just everything. I mean, it doesn't take away from anybody else, but definitely Harold's influence is, and I know for me personally, it's what kept me, you know, balanced. That would have been a hard movie to make without Harold, for me.
After the film wrapped, Harold took Ernie aside.
It was the last day, and we were kind of getting ready, and I took off my jumpsuit, and I saw Harold. He said, "You're taking your jumpsuit," and I said, No, I don't think so. I hadn't planned to. He said, "Ernie, you know, yeah, I mean, take it." And I said, "You sure?" He said, "Ernie, we're the Ghostbusters." And so I kept my jumpsuit from both the movies. And I always remember him saying, we're the Ghostbusters. There can't be no Ghostbuster to me without some kind of tribute.
Coming up, we'll find out how a groundhog broke up one of the strongest comedic friendships of all time. This episode of A Life Lived is sponsored by Zola. So, I've just come back from a really lovely wedding. It's one of my best friends, and it was such a special and beautiful occasion. But I know for a fact, it was a nightmare putting together. Oh, I felt so bad for Charles and Katie. I mean, getting everything and everyone together, and the flowers and the food and the invitations. I mean, it's so important to make that day so special and so perfect. And they worked so hard to do it. But there's another way. Zola is reinventing the wedding planning and registry experience. It's there to help make the happiest moment in a couple's lives just a little bit easier. With Zola, you can manage everything online in just one place, so you don't need to have a whole address book filled with people and annoying assistants and stuff. Forget it. You can choose your free wedding website from over hundreds of different stunning designs. I mean, it's nice to have options, isn't it? You can add photos, stories about how you and your partner just met, as well as accommodation info for the people who are coming in from overseas, right? Zola's got a gorgeous suite of beautiful wedding invitations as well. That also includes free envelopes, free guest addressing, and free online RSVP service as well. Plus, Zola's the only place where you can register for your honeymoon funds and gift cards, along with physical gifts as well. So forget getting three of the same stupid blender that you didn't even want. It was your aunt's suggestion to begin with, right? So because you listened to A Life Lived, you can build your free wedding website on Zola, and you get $50 towards your registry just by going to zola.com/lifelived. That's zola.com/LIFELIVED for a free wedding website and $50 towards your registry. I mean, come on! I'm gonna get married soon, and you better believe I'm jumping on that pool. Zola, it's the wedding company who will do anything for love. We're also sponsored this week by Quip. So here's a question for you. What makes a better toothbrush? Is it industrial strength and power? Multiple modes and Bluetooth connectivity? I mean, if you ask your dentist, they'll tell you it's less about the brush itself and more about how you use it. Quip is one of the first electric toothbrushes accepted by the American Dental Association, and it's backed by over 25,000 dental professionals. I mean, Quip comes with a built-in timer. It pulses every 30 seconds, so you can guarantee that you'll have a nice even clean for that all-important 2 minutes of brushing. And you won't be cleaning your teeth with stinky old toothbrush heads either. Nope. Quip automatically delivers new ones to your door every 3 months for just $5. I mean, the sleek, intuitive design, it's simple to use. And it comes with a travel cap that doubles as a mirror mount, which, you know, kudos. Plus, there are no wires, no clunky charger, none of that. It runs on a single charge for 3 months. Quip starts at just $25, and you'll get the first refill for free at getquip.com/lived. Help form fresh oral health habits and start brushing better with Quip today. Go to quip.com/lived and get your first refill for free. That's GETQUIP.com/LIVED. Ghostbusters was magnanimous. Not only as a film, but also for merchandising. I mean, there wasn't a child who didn't want a proton pack or convince people that they had seen a ghost. It's Harold's greatest success and is still incredibly popular.
When Ghostbusters came out, and my dad would pick me up from school, and all the kids in school would be sort of clamoring to get autographs or to show him their, you know, proton pack backpack or whatever it was. You know, he really loved it, and I loved seeing him sort of delight in the attention. He wasn't famous for LA. You know, he could still walk around and not get recognized.
Harold's next project was writing and directing an island comedy starring Robin Williams. It was called Club Paradise. And although it had a star-studded cast including Peter O'Toole and Twiggy, it was not a box office success. Such a defeat after the high of Ghostbusters was not easy to rebound from. At around the same time, Harold decided to get a divorce. He had fallen in love with his colleague, Erica. Harold had very little downtime during this period in his career, but when he did, he filled it with music.
He always played music. He played, you know, acoustic guitar a lot. I mean, he would just sort of noodle around on the guitar and strum away as he was talking or thinking, or even sometimes, you know, while he was working in the sort of thinking stages of writing, he would be there strumming on the guitar. He also got really into African drumming in his 40s, like during the whole men's group sort of thing. He did some African drum workshops in LA and, you know, had a room full of drums and musical instruments, and everyone would come over and they would sort of get loose on the percussion and drums. And, you know, as a teenager, I thought it was mortifying. But yes, he loved to sing and play like Beatles songs and old folk music. And, you know, when I was a kid, he would, you know, sing verse after verse after verse of all these songs that I requested, you know, Hole in the Bucket or Streets of Laredo. Like, he definitely was always a musical person.
Harold began working on Ghostbusters 2 while planning to marry Erica. He always considered himself a humanist, but his fiancée was an avid Buddhist and introduced him to the culture. Buddhism was such an integral part of their lives that they even befriended the Dalai Lama. In 1989, the long-awaited sequel was released. It was not nearly as successful as the first film. People had moved on from the fun-loving Ghostbusters to other pulp culture icons like Batman and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Harold dedicated his time after the film to his new family. When he wasn't writing or banging on drums, he always had a project on the go.
He was a very dedicated hobbyist. He, one year, decided to make hats for everyone, so he sewed these fleece, like, sort of Russian-style hats. I have a few of them at home. He got into, like, knots and made a bunch of keychains of, like, this monkey fist knot for people. He would make all of our school projects for us. He made a very elaborate banana in a banana peel. He sewed this, like, felt banana for my brother for a play that he was in. I mean, he liked doing little things. He liked getting lost in a task. You know, right before he got sick, he built an acoustic guitar with this guy from a local music, with the help of someone from the local music store and also a good family friend. You know, they made a whole workstation. He got all the tools and he built this guitar. He really liked having a project that he could sort of start, see through, and then finish.
Harold's fire wasn't out yet. He had been working on a script that would bring our purpose on Earth into question, and he asked his best friend to come on the journey with him. In 1992, he wrote and directed Bill Murray in Groundhog Day. During the filming, an argument between Bill and Harold escalated to the point where Harold grabbed Bill by the collar and pushed him up against a wall. The incident caused a 20-year rift in their relationship.
You know, unfortunately, all good things must come to an end. And I think during Groundhog Day, you know, they just had had enough of each other. You know, I don't know because I've never talked to Bill about it. He's never spoken publicly about it. You know, my dad didn't really understand, you know, what happened to really fracture their friendship to the degree that it was. But they needed a break, which is fine. And they took a long break. And eventually, you know, they were able to reconnect when my dad was ill. You know, Bill came and visited him. And, you know, I don't think they really discussed specifics, but they made their peace. And I think they were both really grateful to have the opportunity to do that.
The film is the most beloved and respected body of work Harold created. Film schools have entire classes dedicated to the ethical questions, the complicated storylines, and the brilliant filming. Harold would continue to make great films over the next few years, including Multiplicity, Analyze This, Orange County, and The Ice Harvest. But more and more, his family would be the center of his universe. His daughter remembered an important life lesson shared between them over a joint.
I was like, okay, well, let's do this thing that we both seem to really enjoy doing together. And you know, I mean, he was the same. He maybe talked a little more and was a little more sort of, I don't know, whatever those things are, ideas, you know, making some sort of big connections that maybe wouldn't be apparent to a sober person. But it was great to sort of share in that other dimension with him. You know, he was always very frank with me about drugs when I was a kid. I never, you know, got into anything extreme on his advice. You know, he was just no powders, no pills. And that's great advice. You know, if you can stick to that, you'll probably be okay. And And so, you know, I was pretty responsible with my drug use, as he mostly was. And it was just became this sort of other element of our relationship, where I could, you know, certainly go to him for guidance on serious matters, but also we could just hang out and smoke and watch a movie, and that was really great too. He really knew a lot about psychology. He knew a lot about relationships, you know, a lot about history. So if I came to him, you know, feeling anxious about the world or, you know, George Bush or whatever, and I would say, oh, my God, you know, things have never been this bad. And he would say, well, let me tell you about, you know, medieval Europe. and he just sort of had this great big picture perspective on stuff like that in terms of, you know, relationship stuff or, you know, when I got pregnant as a teenager, like, he just took everything in stride. You know, he would say, you know, what are you feeling? You know, what do you want? And he would just sort of distill things down to a very basic and personal level, where it wasn't about, oh, other people are going to judge me, or, you know, now I've ruined the rest of my life, you know, for this. You know, he would just sort of say, like, it's fine. Everyone screws up. And, you know, we're going to make it work, and it's going to be okay.
It was this fatherly advice that landed him the role of Seth Rogen's dad in the 2007 film Knocked Up. Time in between projects got longer and longer, and with a new generation of comedic actors, writers, and directors taking over Hollywood, Harold's work would become a footnote. He was barely recognized anymore.
We were in Chicago, and we went in, and they said, you know, it's about an hour and a half wait, and he, you know, was sort of waiting for them to recognize him and say, oh, well, Mr. Ramis, of course, right this way, but they didn't. And so then he called his assistant, Pam, and asked her to call the restaurant to say, like, I believe Harold Ramis is there. can you put him on the phone? And I was just like, please let it go. You know, but he would not. And I remember we all had a lovely meal at the Cheesecake Factory eventually. But yeah, that was weird to see him like that, because I just really knew him as sort of the ultimate down-to-earth, you know, non-Hollywood type guy.
In May 2010, Harold got an infection that resulted in complications from autoimmune inflammatory vasculitis. He lost the ability to walk. And while recovering, he suffered a relapse in late 2011.
It was just hard to not know what was going on for so long. And it did take a while, you know, to really figure out what was happening. Autoimmune things are very mysterious. And as much as we know about the human body and the brain, you know, we really don't know that much, I've realized. So, you know, it was terrible to see him affected in the way that he was, because, you know, his brain, like, was just such a huge part of his life and his relationship. I mean, you know, to go from being the smartest guy in the room to somebody who, you know, went through times when he couldn't speak, I mean, it was really devastating for us and for him.
On February 24th, 2014, Harold died in his Chicago home.
There was a sense of relief when he did pass that, you know, he wasn't suffering anymore. So, you know, if you can say, you know, that it was the best possible death experience, you know, maybe it was. I mean, we all got to be with him, you know, through the illness. And when he died, you know, he was surrounded by the people that really just loved him and were a part of him.
Harold built his career showing the flaws in human nature and making them okay.
During one of those sort of stoned conversations, you know, where I was like, what is being an adult all about, you know? And he said, you know, really it's just about embracing ambiguity. And, you know, who knows what that means to a 22-year-old. You know, it didn't mean much to me. I heard the words, but I didn't understand them. It's only as time passes that you realize, yeah, there really is no black and white. As strongly as you can feel about something, it can change. You know, whatever judgment you have towards yourself or others, you know, it will shift. And so, yeah, I mean, that's what the mess is all about, is just knowing that, you know, you're going to make mistakes. You're not always going to be the person that you want to be. People will let you down. It doesn't mean they're bad people. And really, you just have to keep trying to do the best you can and be the best person you can be. And you know, I think as a parent, you know, you just keep trying and failing every day.
Harold's legacy is vast and has impacted generations of comedians and filmmakers. But most importantly, his work filled the living rooms of families with laughter for decades. At Harold's memorial, he was remembered for his contribution to comedy, his Buddhist spirituality, his talents in the drum circle, and for being an overall mensch.
He was very talented, humble, kind, generous guy. Just a good man, which is for me the greatest compliment that you can give a man. He was a good man, period. I don't, I mean, all the work, we all do the work, and some of us do it better than others. All the accomplishments, all this stuff, at the end of the day, he was a good man. And I think that for me, that kind of says it all. Yeah, he was a good man.
Violet Ramis Steele's book, Ghostbuster's Daughter, Life with My Dad Harold Ramis, is available wherever you buy or download your books. Next time on A Life Lived.
They knew they were doing something cool. The kids in the audience were getting more and more stoned. It was a little out of control, which made the director a little nervous, but Kurt thought it was cool. The more chaotic it got, those shots, that sense of weirdness was part of the power of the video. So he conceived of the whole thing. You know, he storyboarded it. He knew every shot that he wanted in it. He was a full Renaissance artist.
Nirvana's manager, Danny Goldberg, takes us inside the mind of the rebellious voice of Generation X, Kurt Cobain. This is an Audio Boom original production by Muddy Knees Media and Breaking Stereotypes. This podcast is presented and executive produced by me, Stephanie Okupniak, assistant produced by Paige Waller. I can't thank you enough for all the amazing feedback you've been giving us on this podcast and all the incredible suggestions that you've given us on icons that you want to hear about in future episodes. So if there is an icon that you would like to know more about, you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram using the handle @alifelived_.